Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Part two of your Ben Jarofsky Show for Wednesday, June 24th is still brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, there's the Brown Line, and of course, our good friends at the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
It was about a week ago. I was talking to my dear friend Monroe Anderson, and regular guest right here in the Ben Jarofsky Show every Wednesday. We just got off the show with him, and we were talking about Spike Lee's Defy Bloods, the movie about five veterans, black veterans of the United States war with Vietnam. And Monroe said, you have to talk to my dear friend, my former college roommate, Charles Ellison. He's a musician, jazz musician. He's a professor. He lives in Montreal. But you have to hear his story about his service as a soldier in Vietnam. So he gave me the number. One thing led to another, and I had a delightful conversation with Charles Ellison, and he agreed to come on the show. We'll be talking about it all day. Charles Ellison, welcome to my show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And yes, indeed, Charles Ellison. I could just trying to picture this, a young Charles Ellison and a young Monroe Anderson as roommates together. That could be a sitcom. And but we'll leave some of the goofier exploits that you two 17 or 18 year olds did back in 1965, I think it was, or 66.
There you go, yes.
65. So why don't we start the story, Charles, by telling how it was that we're a little bit about your life before you got to Bloomington and eventually joined the Army. You're from Indiana, correct?
Well, no, I'm originally from Trenton, Tennessee.
Okay.
Trenton, Tennessee is a very small town in western Tennessee. It's in close proximity to Jackson, Tennessee. Jackson, Tennessee figures prominently into black history in that that's where Kente and that whole thing happened with our church there, right next door. So I grew up in Trenton. In my first year of high school, my family moved to from Trenton to Jackson. And in Jackson, Tennessee, I went to Lincoln Elementary School, which was just a regular, beautiful school. And, you know, just doing my thing. Everything was segregated there then at the time. And one summer, I had the occasion to visit Tennessee and reconnect with my two homeboys, Nero Lawrence and Willie James Harrison. Mm-hmm. Both of them had begun playing trumpet in their high school band. And so they were having a rehearsal, and they said, "Well, Charles, would you like to come?" I said, "Sure, I'd like to come." And so they allowed me to come to the rehearsal, and the band director was so nice, he allowed me to sit in the trumpet section with them. They both played trumpet, and they started rehearsing. And I was just amazed with the beauty of the sounds, with the sense of community, with the sense of single-mindedness, with the sense of melody, of rhythm, of harmony, all of these things that spoke to me somehow. And I will never forget that. I just loved it so, so much. So that was that. We went back home and everything. Then I returned to Jackson for my first year at the high school. And about, I guess about halfway through the year, they made an announcement that there would be a music class, and who wants to be in it? My hand went up right away. Yes. And what do you want to play? Trumpet. So I told my parents that I'd like to be in the band and play trumpet. And of course, we were very poor. We didn't know it, but we were poor. And they said, "Well, God, I don't know if we can or how we can afford you an instrument, Charles." But at any rate, they got me an instrument. I got in the band, and Mr. Lawrence McClellan was the teacher. and he was so good. I showed a lot of just a lot of proclivity for the instrument. I was able to advance myself without private lessons, and I started to compose right away. I didn't know what I was doing, but I would we play a song, you know, and then I'd write something out, and I'd take it to him and say, "Mr. Clement, look at this, what I wrote." He said, "Oh, Charles," he said, "this is very interesting. It probably looked like hieroglyphics," but he said, "it's very interesting." He said, "Now, could you sing what you have here?" And I would sing it. He said, "Very interesting melody, very interesting." He said, "You know, music is in many ways mathematics, and you just lack a little information. So I want to give you some of the information that you're lacking, you know." And so he explained to me about sounds and silences and how to deal with both of them and that kind of thing. And I started practicing, and I guess I was something else, because I advanced really, really fast, really, really fast. And but about 2 months into my high school career, my family moved to South Bend, Indiana. Mm. My father had come up already. My father had reached the top of the employment possibilities for black in the Jackson. He worked at a crystal factory, and he wanted to go to Cleveland. But he had a sister in South Bend, Indiana, who insisted that, "Well, you have to come through here and see me before you go to Cleveland." And so he did. My mother and my two siblings, my sister and my youngest brother, stayed, of course. And he went to South Bend. And when he got to South Bend, he found out his sister, Aunt Pearl, had acquired a job for him in South Bend. She said, "You don't need to go to Cleveland. You can stay here." And so he stayed in South Bend, and that's how I stayed in South Bend. Once I'm in South Bend, I'm in a high school, Central High School, which is a downtown high school. Roughly 45% black, 45% white, and the other basically Mexican or Hispanic, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the school was a choice school. Academically and in arts as well. We had a symphony orchestra, 100 pieces. We had a concert band, 100 pieces. We had a chamber orchestra, which was about 45 pieces. We had an orchestra, a pit band for shows that we did. We had a marching band. We had a jazz band. And we had various ensembles. So it was incredible. It was just incredible. And I just moved into that. And I did that and did that and did that. And I graduated and I went to Indiana University.
Now you were going to study Mr.
Bill Adams.
You were going to study music?
Study music, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You see, in Jackson and stuff, I was showing a lot of interest in science and in physics and that sort of thing. And they were saying, "Oh, Charles is going to be a physicist. He's going to be a doctor," or something like that. So my family was thinking about that. And cool music came into my life. And they said, "Oh, my God, Charles, you want to be a musician? I said, "Yes." And they stuck by me. They were very young. They had me when they were 16. Mm. But they stuck by me. They said, "Charles, we'll do everything we can for you." He said, but don't do this as a hit or miss thing. You got to hit, you know. So they supported, you know. It was beautiful. Now, and I remember getting in South Bend.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go on.
I just have a quick question for you. Was there sort of a trumpet player that you styled yourself on, that you almost dressed like or looked like or wanted to be? Was there anyone at the top?
Of course. There were two. There was Clifford Brown, and there was Rafael Mendez. Rafael Mendez, a famous Mexican trumpet player who actually ruled with Pancho Villa. And he was just an incredible virtuoso. And Clifford Brown was a great trumpet player. And, of course, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, all of those people I loved. But at the time, my idol was John Parrish. John Parrish was a local trumpet player. And Grady Black, friend, they both went to Lane College there in Jackson, Tennessee, and John was just really, oh my God, he was just beautiful. So I wanted to be like him, but John was a kindred spirit to Clifford Brown and to Lee Morgan and to Buccalotto. Booker Louisville was from Memphis. Booker is one of the greatest people to ever play the music. He died at age 24 from sickle cell.
Here we are. You're enrolling in Indiana. I just had this flash. You met young Monroe Anderson that very year that you enrolled in Indiana?
I did. And oh boy, we were kindred spirits in a lot of ways. We're young. We both come from black communities. We were highly motivated, and we were just young, you know, just young and foolish in some ways as young folks, but we were just enjoying ourselves, and we hooked up and became really, really good friends, really, really dear friends, and we've maintained that friendship over the years.
I could just picture Monroe in 1965. He must have looked like he was 8 years old.
Oh, you should see me go into my philosophy classes. I used to wear this tweed jacket and carry a smoker pipe.
The young scholar from South Bend with his pipe. I'm a young scholar. You're a young scholar at University of Indiana in 1965, 66. That's your freshman year. You're studying the trumpet. You've got aspirations to be the next Clifford Brown or Rafael Diaz.
I'm studying the trumpet with the great one and only Mr. William Adam. Mr. William Adam, we just finished a symposium of 3 days. It's called the William Adam Trumpet Festival. It was supposed to happen in Washington this year, but because of the COVID, it was happening online. And so there were 3 days of presentations on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of last week. And let me tell you, they were just something else. And Mr. Adam was a genius. His trumpet player plays. Bobby Burns is from Monroe's hometown, Gary, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Plays with Earth, Wind, and Fire. He has people who played. Jerry Hay wrote a lot of trumpet music for Quincy Jones. Charlie Davis, one of the greatest lead players in California and in Las Vegas. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And people not really well known. You know, he has the principal trumpet player with the Brooklyn Philharmonic is one of his students too. It just goes on and on. It's so beautiful.
So you're studying with the great William Adam. How did you go from being a student studying Indiana to joining the military?
Well, I played in various bands down there. You know, I played in with the great Al Kolbein. Al Kolbein was a composer, arranger, and tenor saxophonist who held a band in Bloomington. And most of the people who went through there, the good players, were able to play in his band. I was very lucky to play in his band along with the great lead trumpet player Larry Wiseman. And Al's band was the road band for Henry Mancini. We played with Tom Jones. We played with big names like that. We just go out and do all of those things. And so it got so good to me that I stopped going to classes and stuff. And I actually took some time off to do that. And I got drafted.
Wow.
So I had to, I had to determine whether I was going to either go to Vietnam or whether I was going to go to jail. And I looked at going to jail, and it was okay, except they were not going to let me have my horn. So I said, well, no, I can't do that. So I said, well, maybe I could just desert. And I said, well, I looked into that. I said, I don't know about that. I said, well, let me see what it's going to take for me to survive in Vietnam. So I always believed in prayer and all of that kind of stuff. And I did some serious meditation on it. And I talked to a returning veteran from Vietnam, mm-hmm. Alan Barnes, a great tenor saxophone player from Detroit, who went on to be a part of the Blackbirds, led by Donald Byrd, a great trumpet player, who taught at Howard University. And so he told me stuff that I had to know. He gave me two sets of information I won't share with you, but things that I knew how to get out of the country. And he just gave me two pivotal pieces of information that I needed that I said, okay, I'll go to Nam and I'll survive it. So I ended up going to Nam.
What year was this?
Uh, I was 68. Yes, yes.
So 1968, you're 22 years old, and you're a trumpet player, a jazz man, and basically a person. You just talked about meditation. You're obviously not someone who likes to fight. You're
right.
A conciliatory person. Just take us through landing or arriving in Vietnam. First of all, you were in the Army, I presume? They got drafted, so you're in the Army, correct?
Yes, I was in the Army.
And how did you handle the Army discipline and the way they treated GIs? And
That was terrible. You know, when I went to basic training, I took with me Bertrand Russell's Why Are We in Vietnam. I took all kinds of books, you know. I took Stokely Carmichael's book. I just took all kinds of books with me to basic training, and I'm reading them. And so they inspected my stuff and they said, "Wait a minute, whose stuff is this? Why are we in Vietnam?" I said, "It's mine, sir." He said, "I show you what we think of this." And he threw it in the trash can and lit it on fire. In the fire next time, he threw it in and lit it on fire. He lit all my books on fire. And he said, "Ellison, you won't be needing that stuff here." And I just looked at him, you know. He said, that's how that went. And so we had to fill out a questionnaire and say, you know, about taking orders and stuff. And would you follow an order that you felt was unethical? I said, "No, I won't follow it." So the guy said, "Ellison, you really been compromising your time here in the military with those kinds of statements. We don't feel too good about that." So we proceeded on with the stuff. And then they called me out. They said, "Charles, we want you to speak with this captain." And so I went and spoke with the captain. And he said, "Ellison," he said, "Well, you don't really realize it, but you're kind of lucky today." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, the stuff that you wrote down could get you put in jail, could get you put out of the Army or whatever, you know." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry, but that's how I feel." And he said, and it turned out that he was a trumpet player, okay? Mm-hmm. He was working for the CID, but he was a trumpet player, and he had played with some big bands and stuff, and he knew that I was a trumpet player. And he said, "Well, Mr. Ellison," he said, "what do you want?" And I said, "Well, I just want a chance to audition." He said, "We could send you to an artillery unit, we could send you to a fighting unit, whatever." I said, "No, I just want a chance to audition. That's it. You know, I've been to university. I've been studying this stuff. I want a chance to audition." And he laughed at me and he said, "Ellison, you got it." So I got into a band. I auditioned and got into the 399th Army Band at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. We had two bands there, 399th and the 423rd. I got into the 399th. And I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. You're with your story. Go ahead.
So there again, I was lucky. I didn't like KP and all of that stuff, and so I was assigned bugle duty, which meant that I had a van, I had a driver, and I would get extra duty pay when I left the base to go play these funerals. So we got all around Arizona and to Arkansas and southern Missouri and all of that stuff to play these things. And I would just go out and play to the grave site, and I'd play a taps. Occasionally I'd play a silver taps. That's taps shared by two trumpets who are dislocated by a certain distance, and we play da da da. He answers da 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 da, so forth and so on. We do the whole thing, and oh my God, I had some really funny experiences with what I call rednecks in Arkansas. But I survived it all, and my driver and I. So I was cool. I mean, I didn't have to pull KT. I didn't have to do any of those things. I was just kind of, and I spend my time in the library reading up on military law. I became quite conversant with military law. I knew what you could do and what you could not do. And so a person would say something to me, and I said, and I recite the regulation. stupid, you know. So, my God.
I'm surprised they didn't just kick you out.
I don't know.
They kicked Jimi Hendrix out. They should have kicked you out. Go on.
That would have been nice. That would have been nice. But we started a university. Okay. We had the University of the Streets at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Everybody taught what they could take. I taught philosophy and music. And the other folks, we had some people who didn't know anything, but all they could teach was dealing with dope. But everybody could make their presentation. This was the University of the Streets that we did in Vietnam. Oh my God, it was beautiful, and it was because of that I got sent to Vietnam.
Wait,
it was the University of the Streets by being in the military.
Yes,
it was because of that they sent me to Vietnam.
Explain that the correlation.
Well, it was something that the military didn't like. They didn't like, you know, I mean, somebody having all this knowledge about the military, and for us to be having, actually helping one another learn something, and even the poorest of us, in terms of formal education and stuff, everybody had something to contribute, and they didn't like that.
So, Charles, let me just stop you for a moment and ask you this question. So, had you not formed the University of the Streets, had you not gone in that direction, had you instead continued to play taps at funerals, and I know there was no shortage of funerals because the Vietnam War was heating up and there were bodies coming back. So had you just, you could have served out your, 2-year commitment in the Army just playing taps in the United States? Am I correct in that?
Well, perhaps. They can always change your orders. You know, you never know what they're going to do to you. But yes, theoretically, that was a high possibility that could have happened. Yes.
But instead, you were a troublemaker with the University of the Streets, and so they rewarded you, in quotes, rewarded, punished you by sending you to Vietnam.
Yes, right. That's right. That's right.
Which, by the way, let's just pause. Just how counterintuitive that is for the Army. You would think the Army, in order to, quote-unquote, win the war in Vietnam, would send over people who wanted to fight in the war in Vietnam. Instead, the Army was using the war in Vietnam as a way to punish a man who clearly didn't want to fight and would not be that productive as a soldier. Do you follow what I just said?
Yeah, but I would be productive as a soldier. I mean, I'm a fighter. I was just born that way. Nobody's going to kick my ass. If I had to fight, I would fight. I would have been a good soldier if I had to fight. Now, fortunately, I was in situations the whole time that I was there, for 1 year and 5 days, by the way. I never had to initiate anything that was offensive in terms of fighting. I only had to react defensively, but there were many times, you know, to react into mortars, to rockets, to snipers, to things like that. And of course, you have to fight then. But we never had to go out and just engage, seek out folks like so many of the people. I mean, the story that you really need to hear, you need to hear some people who walk point, people who are fighting, actually fighting every day, you know, who woke up with rockets, went to bed with rockets, who woke up with snipers, who all kinds of stuff. I can recall, Ben, playing. We had these things that we would play after I was in the Army over there. We would play. I was in the 101st Airborne, Screaming Eagle, Death from Above Division. That's what was our thing, was Death from Above, driving, jumping in our parachutes. We didn't have to do that in Vietnam, of course, but that was our thing, Death from Above. Okay, so I forgot my train of thought. I'll come back to it. But I remember being landed over there, and I had just come into country, okay? Mm-hmm. And I remember meeting people on the plane on the way over there. We were just talking, you know, brothers and stuff. We were just talking and stuff, and wishing that everybody would get back home, you know? And so I'd been there for about 4 months or so. and we were playing a stand down. That's when you go and you play a show for troops who've been out in the field, and they return for a day or two, and they can drink beer and eat and sleep in regular beds and all that kind of stuff. And I looked up and I saw this friend of this guy who I'd gone over on the plane with. They were coming from a fight. And his boots, I looked down at his boots. His boots are normally black, but they were white. They'd been brushed off by all the jungle brush and stuff. And I looked at him and I said, "Brother Jones, it's so good to see you." He said, "Chaz, take care of your trumpet, because your trumpet is taking care of you." And I almost cried. I almost cried. And the trumpet did take care of me. The trumpet took care of me so many times, Ben. I mean, it took care of me. It took care of me. It's Father's Day was the last Sunday. My daughter, I have a 17-year-old daughter who drew, make me a Father's Day card. And we have a place at the lake in the Little Engines. We were up there. Beautiful day and everything. And she gave me this card. It was so beautiful. It was so beautiful. It was a trumpet that had like a flower coming out of the bell of the trumpet. The bell was vertical, okay? Coming out of it, there was a flower with love blossoms, and it said, "Happy birthday, happy Father's Day, Dad." And all these beautiful flowers and rays and stuff. And then you look at the trumpet and you see where the mouthpiece receiver is. She had roots coming out of the trumpet. The trumpet was alive. I said, "Oh my God!" I cried. I said, "Thank you, Fiona. This is the best thing I ever received." It was so beautiful, man. If you could have seen it, oh my God! I said, "I'm going to take a photograph of this, and I'm going to frame this. Yeah, I'm going to frame this. It's going to be part of my legacy and your legacy, Fiona. This is just beautiful." So you see all these little things. All these little things are related, you know. All of these things are related. I remember going to Monroe's house when he and Joyce had Scott, you know, and then they had Kyle. And I used to be in this one room, and the boys would sneak in the morning and wake me up. They'd sneak in. I'd be on the couch or on the bed like I'm sleeping, you know, yeah. But I would be awake because they had, you know, and they'd be discussing, "Do you think he's awake? Why don't you lift one eye?" One of them reached down to my eye and started over. I know, I think he's asleep. I mean, all these things I just think about. I just, it's just beautiful. It's really beautiful.
All right, now let's go back to that quote that man told you in Vietnam, and I wrote it down and amplify it a little bit and explain exactly what he means. Quote, "Chaz, take care of your trumpet because your trumpet is taking care of you."
Yes. Well, he's out there in the bush. I mean, he's out there every day in the bush. I'm eating regular food. He's eating like sea rations and stuff. You know, he's been pinned down by snipers. He told me that he was personally pinned down for a whole day by a sniper behind a tree. He said if he moved one fraction of an inch, there was a bullet there. He went through that. He was terrorized all day long. All day long. This is somebody's son. This is not a movie. This is somebody's son who was in church the other day. You know what I'm saying? Who was going to school, who was playing football, basketball, baseball. Who had a girlfriend, a human being, Black Lives Matter. Yes. Somebody like that. You know? So it was just terrible. So he has a place in my heart, even today.
Is he still alive?
I can just think back. I don't know. You know, the whole thing about the bloods, you know, the five bloods and our bloods, I had five bloods too. I mean, we had a lot of folks over there, but there were five brothers, and I were really tight. And I think about that stuff. I said, "Oh my God!" And you know, one of the five bloods, Earl Clifton from Rochester, New York, looked me up. He heard me somehow. I don't know how he found out I was living in Montreal, but he came up from Rochester, New York, and found me. And he's a trumpet player too. Could really, really play. He's from Florida, from St. Pete. He could from Jacksonville. I'm sorry. He could really, really play. He had one of the best articulations of any trumpet player I've ever heard in my life. Because down there, in their marching band, they had to do this thing. There's an exercise book called Arban. They go, dun, 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 dun. Now, they'd have the mouthpiece on their lips. They go, dun, they'd have to take it off and reset it for, dun, 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 dun. And they could do that at, dun, 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 dun. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I never heard anybody with that kind of articulation. But we became really tight, really, really tight. And unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago. He had he had a really bad kidney, and he didn't have PTS. None of us had. I don't think he had that strife and stuff, PTSD. But he was beautiful. And Johnny L.A. Robertson, I don't know what happened. We lost track of him. Thomas A. Chappelle was a minister from Tulsa. He passed away. Grady, I don't know wherever. Grady was from New York. He's a brother. He left one night. He said, Charles, I'm fed up with this. I'm leaving. In the middle of the night, he said, can we come down to the shower and play one more time? He played tenor saxophone. We went down and we played at about 2 o'clock in the morning. The brother's down in the shower playing. And then he left. I never heard of him again.
Well, he just walked out?
He left the base.
Went AWOL.
Yes.
In Vietnam.
I don't know whether he got killed.
Wow.
In Vietnam. I don't know whether he got killed or whether he found a woman in a place somewhere that accepted him or whether he got to Hanoi. I don't know. But he was headed for Hanoi.
Wow. What's his name?
Grady.
Grady, if you're listening, give us a call. If by chance you're out there. What a scene. You in that shower with Grady at 2 in the morning, just playing a farewell song.
Cuban Master Caleb's thing. Oh, man. We were hitting all kinds of Caleb.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 We were hitting all that stuff, you know. Because we had a band, we had the regular marching band that would play change of command ceremonies and, as I said, stand downs and all that kind of stuff. But we had a small band. I'm sorry, the small band played stand downs. And we were kind of like, I remember Blood, Sweat, and Tears was very, very popular at the time. So I transcribed their music, you know, spinning wheel and all that. God goes up. Spinning wheel, you know, but we did James Brown stuff. We did all the, just everything, stuff from Detroit. We did the stuff from Memphis, you know. I wrote a piece called Foo by Soul Stew based upon my man's Memphis Soul Stew. Oh, Foo by Soul Stew was mean. Oh, we used to play that. The producers would just go crazy. And the Vietnamese would go crazy, too, because one time we were playing, like, at an artillery unit that was in the base of this valley, and with mountains all around it. It was big. It had like 16 howitzers in an oblong configuration around us, and we were in the middle playing. We played Foo by Soul Stew. It got so bad, it was so mean that when the applause stopped, we heard the applause coming from outside of the perimeter.
That's wild.
And the officer said. Play that again, and we played it again, and he was able to coordinate and see how what the distance was for a grenade launcher. You know, we could just shoot it, fire it up, you know, if we needed to. And but VC. VC had tunneled in, spying on us, got close to us, but they got high. They got high, and they were just enjoying themselves. They were partying with us.
That's wild.
So the officer, to his what should I say? I would say his good judgment said, we're just going to let them go. He didn't shoot it up.
To his credit, yes.
He did not. He just let them go. Yeah. Things like you make those kinds of decisions over there, you know, from time to time. You just let them know that everybody was partying, you know. And then the next day we found yes, there was a bunker that they had dug in, and we could tell that they had, you know, they had got high, and they escaped in the night, you know, just went on somewhere else.
But while they were there, they enjoyed your music. Trumpet really did save you.
Absolutely.
The trumpet saved you. So now, was it racially segregated in Vietnam, or were the people that you hung around with all black, or were there any white people?
Vietnam was the most racially segregated thing you could imagine. I remember one time going out to a place to play. It was somewhere south of us. My whole thing was, whenever I went somewhere new, I looked for depressions in the earth. I looked for something that where I could take shelter if I was sniped at, or if rockets or mortars came in. And I saw this concrete bunker, and I said, oh, shit, that's my place. And I went to the bunker, and I got to the bunker, and there was a sign there that said, whites only.
Damn. They just put it out there. Whites only.
Whites only, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, in our van, your van, so you play together, you play music together. But there was very little real racial intermingling. There was Brian Breezley Bros, a person from Tripp, South Dakota, who was a trombonist, and he played double bass, electric bass in the band. He was something. Brian was just crazy. He was just crazy. Mm. But he was the brother. We made him an honorary brother. He would ride on the trucks with us when we traveled through the jungle. He would ride on the trucks with us. He's the only one we would let ride with us. They would have us go out and we play the Clear Village. Okay. They clear a village, and then they burn it, and we play a march.
That's very bizarre.
Yeah. This shit happens. Shit like that would happen.
So I don't know if the word enjoy is the appropriate word. I can't think of another one, but you're playing music. You're playing music in a war zone. You're playing music for people who are either killing or in danger of being killed. So I don't know if the word enjoy is applicable, but you are playing music. So would you say enjoying yourself? Oh, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Anytime you played, even if we were playing a march, John Philip Sousa's marches and all of that kind of stuff. We enjoyed playing. We enjoyed that. Now, when you know that you're playing for a village that's being tortured, we didn't like that. We had to play, but you didn't like that. Mm-hmm. You did not like that. When we were playing a change of command ceremony and rockets start to come in, well, we just go in and find the first hole we could jump in, and we were enjoying playing, and we just go on and finish enjoying. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we played formal concerts for the officers, or formal dances for them, and things like that. You enjoyed that. And they enjoyed the music that I wrote and the organization that we had. Mm-hmm. You know, so my bandmaster was a warrant officer, and he was from Hawaii. And he really didn't like, he was just a staunch military guy, you know. But he was new there, and he got on me for not having my boots bloused one time, you know. Mm-hmm. And that means you tuck your trousers into your boots and stuff. And so he said, Ellison? I said, yes. He said, your boots are not bloused. I said, I'm sorry, sir. You know, he said, well, that's improper. You do that. If you do that again, you're going to be in serious trouble. Thank you, sir. And it was on. And then one time a rocket attack occurred, you know, mm-hmm. and we had dug bunkers outside our hooches and stuff. It was his first rocket attack. and he froze. He froze. The rockets were coming in. We just ran in. So I grabbed him, and I threw him in the bunker. And I jumped on top of him. I said, well, sir, you're going to have to react a little quickly. Your wife and your dog at home will never see you again. At that point on, we were tight.
And from that point on, you saved his life. What is it? Your boots are not. What's the final word, just so everybody can know?
Blouse. You have up at the top of your boots, you have a little like a garter, mm-hmm. and you put your pants in the garter.
I got it.
And they're bloused.
I got you.
Yeah.
So you're playing music in Vietnam, which is it does sound like a dark comedy. It really does, like a dark comedy. I could just see a movie being made of this, Charles. You're playing music in Vietnam. We had a discussion on the show about a week ago, which I urge everybody, if they haven't heard it already, check it out. Sergio Mims and Danielle mm-hmm. Scruggs, two really smart film critics here in Chicago, picking apart mm-hmm. Spike Lee's Defy Bloods and what it means and what they thought okay. about it and putting mm-hmm. it in the... So I'm not going to do a Defy Bloods thing again because we already have it once. I urge everybody to see it. And I really don't care if we do spoilers on this interview because, folks, you should have watched it already. It's on Netflix. It's easy to watch. And in my humble opinion... Everyone should watch it. It's not a perfect movie, but it's really well worth watching. Those scenes...
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah,
the scenes that got to me, Charles, and I thought were so powerful, get your response to this, have to do with the character Hanoi Hannah, who is mm-hmm. an English-speaking operative for the North Vietnamese who's playing psychological right. games with black GIs by sending out messages... Mm-hmm. Sending out messages to black GIs over the radio that torment them, where she says, while you're here fighting for a country that disrespects you and dishonors you, you should know that in your home country, Martin Luther King was just assassinated by a white man, and you're fighting a white man's war. And then she would play Marvin Gaye, saying, let's see what Marvin mm-hmm. has to say about it. And I thought that was... they did that like a couple of those very compelling scenes. Did you have any Hannah moments when you were in Vietnam?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Hanoi Hannah would... our band was used for psychological warfare, too. We would make radio broadcasts with either NVA or VC deserters or people who had been captured. And so we'd come on and we'd play stuff. And then featuring, they call me Charlie Trumpet. Lord have mercy. Charlie Trumpet. On this one, you know, and we play and stuff. And then they give their little spiel about the advantages of being on the side of the Americans and of deserting and stuff. And I guess this was being fairly, it was... fairly effective anyway. Somebody in the North Vietnamese intelligence, yeah, decided that no, we gotta quell this stuff. So they started shooting rockets at us. Normally, there was a protocol. You didn't shoot rockets at anybody when it was raining. You didn't shoot it in the morning. You know, there was kind of a little protocol for fighting and stuff, you know. But they violated the protocol all the time. They'd rocket us in the morning, for lunch, for dinner, for at nighttime, all kinds of stuff. It's scared to death. Anywhere we traveled, they knew what mode of operations we were taking. They'd shoot at the trucks. They'd shoot at the choppers we were on. Oh, my God, it was terrible. It was. That's when I came close to exercising one of the things that I had sought out to get me out of the country, one of the two things that I told you I found mm-hmm. out about before going over there. But I did.
And you survived.
And finally, yeah, yeah. So Hannah was very real. Very, very, very. I know she probably, I can't imagine what it did to the psyches of the people out in the field actually doing the fighting.
How what did it do to your psyche?
Oh, nothing to me. You know, I'm in a survival mode, you know. I'm over there. So I just say that such and such is doing her thing again, you know. You know, and that's all, you know.
So
you're in it. You can't be like philosophical and all of that judgmental and stuff. You're in it, and you know that she's doing what she's got to do, and you're doing what you got to do. My thing is to stay alive. Yeah. Her thing is to get me killed, and so that's what it is.
And you stayed alive. When did you finally get out?
Well, I finally got out after a year and 5 days. I was supposed to be able to come home, and planes were not available for us because of some kind of thing involving people in the National Guard stuff, and they had priority over us. Boy, we really acted up, and we finally got out. But there's just so many things that that happened, and I must say too that the things with our white brothers, they were not all negative. You know, there were various white brothers that I that I still talk to, that I, in fact, there's a, we have something online that, 101st Airborne Division, group that we talk, we haven't met or talked lately, but we have photographs of us, all of us send in photographs, and we have a composite of photographs of us. We have we put on obituaries of people who passed on, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and it's really is similar to a comment that you made the other day. Most of my white poke persons are Trump people. They're staunch conservatives, and that's just the way it is.
Well, that's
I would like
go ahead.
I would like to someday visit the wall. I haven't visited the wall yet. It's very hard for me to go to the wall. Sorry.
Okay.
I'd like to go to the wall with some of my people from the NAM. I would even go there with white folks too.
The Trump white folks. Charles,
it's very complicated.
It is complicated.
It's very complicated.
And I pointed this out to you, and I say this all the time. And I'll tell folks the way I said it to you, because it's this observation I've made, I've seen. Somehow or other, and Charles, I already told this to you, so this is going to be an echo of what I already told you, but somehow or other, you could take a black man from South Bend, Indiana, by way of Tennessee, and put him into the Army and send him to Vietnam and have him go through all the life-threatening moments that you went through and bring him back home. And there's no way in the world he's going to vote for Donald Trump. You take the white man, let's say he's from South Bend, Indiana, put him in the same situation, send him to Vietnam, he comes home, his conclusion is, I'm going with Donald Trump. Charles, I will never understand that.
I know, it's crazy. It's so crazy. Well, you know, even in terms of going into the Army, when we went down for our physical and stuff, I should have been rejected. I should have rejected because of my feet. And my fellow white friend who lived down the street from me in South Bend, Indiana, who's Italian, whose feet were his feet were nowhere near mine and stuff. He got rejected because of his feet, and they accepted me and sent me to basic training about that. So you see all of these things that are there, you know, mm-hmm. It's just, it's crazy. It's really, really crazy, you know? And then I go on and I said, well, okay, I go on in life and I keep reading and stuff. And I find out through one of your own folks, Reverend, the doctor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, about things I never knew about black folks, things that I never knew about. I mean, in one of his, you just in one of his interviews, he'll note 15 black PhDs with extraordinary research. You know, he'll note he himself speaks Yiddish, speaks Portuguese, speaks German. It's amazing the kind of stuff that he does, but nobody knows about it. They just know he's Obama's minister who's all a troublemaker over there, and blah 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 blah. And you think about it from your own city. You think about Gwendolyn Brooks. Oh my God, how many people know about it? About Gwendolyn, how many people are hip to Studs Terkel? How many people have read any Studs Terkel's books? Many beautiful books. How many people are hip to his radio archives? My students are. How many people are hip to all of the philanthropic community-based work that Wynton Marsalis does? How many people have checked out his interviews? He has numerous interviews online. How many people know that when Jesse Norman sings Wagner, she sings it like she's German? Her discipline is so on point. She knows German history. She speaks the language. When she sings Wagner, the Germans put their arms around her and say, "Come here, sister. You represent us beautifully." You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Amen.
The world is right out there in front of you, people. You could sup from any of these things, but you choose not to.
There you go.
It's a lot of it.
There you go.
It just comes down.
You can look at Carina Notes of John and Coltrane's A Love Supreme. You know, and I saw that stuff there. Da da da, sha di da, da di da, da di da, da di da. And I said, oh my God, that was a prayer. He actually, all of those things, A Love Supreme saved me. It saved a whole lot of people in the 60s. It made dope people put down their dope. A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. Yeah. How many people are hip to John Coltrane?
Not many.
How many people know about, you know, how many people, let's go to Spike. Spike Lee. How many people are hip to the where Spike comes from? How many people are hip to his father, David Lee?
Bill.
Extraordinary bassist. Extraordinary composer. Extraordinary band leader. Extraordinary American.
Yeah. Bill Lee.
A black American, extraordinary American by anybody's degree.
Yeah.
David Lee. If you want to find that Spike, check out, do a little research, white folks.
Yeah. Bill
and
Lee.
Black folks in the world, do a little research.
All right.
It's out there. The world is out there waiting for you to discover it. And it's more than on television. And it's more than Time magazine. And it's more than any magazine. It's out there for you to discover. And with with stuff online now, there's no reason for you just not to learn how to use it. My students don't know how to use the web as good as I do, as well as I do. I see you guys, you used to these fast little fixes things, but you don't know how to research. Oh no! You don't know how to reject this and that, and now you have to bring the whole thing of determining what's fake news too. But it's part of it's a part of the time continuum that we live in right now.
All right,
and this whole thing, you know, the time that we live in right now, all of the voices of the young people across the world saying Black Lives Matter and our lives matter, and old folks, y'all got to give it up.
All right, now
y'all got to give it up.
to quote Marvin Gaye. All right, let me ask you this question, and we'll close it down with this.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this down as soon as you said it. You mentioned the great Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds, and they had a song way back many years ago. It's I'm doing this off the top of my head. It's called "Where Are You Going? Where Are We Going?" I think it's called
"Where Are We Going?"
All right. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, answer that question. Where are we going? Are you positive when you look at the world from your perch, or are you worried?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, I know we are going, the world, the black folks, the brown folks, the yellow folks, the red folks, all folks are going forward. We are moving forward, not backwards, not sideways. We're moving forward. We are moving forward. We're moving forward towards the light. I'm not talking about light in terms of religious stuff, but we're moving forward towards enlightenment. We're moving forward towards the goal of enlightenment. That's where we move. That's my stuff is about that. That's what I tell my students. I tell my students that you are the member of the human race before you're the member of any of ethnicity. You are a human being. You're a member of the human race. The human race is something that's very special. As far as we know, it's the only one time it's happened. It might be somewhere else out there in the universe, but we don't know about that yet. And boy, it's very, very special. And here on Mother Earth, you have to respect her. She's beautiful. And you have to respect our women. We all come in this world via women. If you ain't got no sheroes, something wrong with you. You got to have as many sheroes as you do heroes. You should have more sheroes than you do heroes. Because it's on them that we move forward.
All right, very good. Charles Ellison, I just want to tell you, our dear friend, our mutual friend, Monroe Anderson, is also very positive. And in very strictly political terms, I'll leave you with this. He was on the show today earlier. He was so optimistic about Donald Trump losing in November. And I think that's a key first step to having a clear sense of where we're going. That he predicted.
Absolutely.
In his optimism, he predicted, are you ready for this, that Alabama and Mississippi would go against Donald Trump in the election. I said, Monroe, whatever you're smoking, I'll have a little of that too.
My man.
Monroe, money, Anderson. Very good. I want to thank you, Charles Ellison. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And we'll probably bring you back, maybe let a month or two go and bring you back, talk politics and music and all kinds of things, all right?
Okay, and I want to thank you very much, Ben, and I want to thank your audience for listening and for receiving whatever I had to say, because it's offered in honesty, it's offered from the bottom of my heart, and I am not a judgmental person, I'm not a racist, I'm a lover of all of God's children. I'm a lover of all of God's children and this wonderful planet that he gave us to exist in. And I move forward.
Very good. Thank you so much, Charles Ellison. That's Charles Ellison. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everyone.
Hey, downloaders. We do this show live. Yeah, you should check it out sometime. Tuesdays through Fridays, 1 until 3 p.m. Central Time at both Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Reader websites, also on the Chicago Sun-Times YouTube channel. Live! Yeah, go check it out!